And welcome back to Fully Equipped, Golf.com's gear-focused podcast, where we take PGA Tour news and relate it to golfers of all skill levels. I'm Tim Breon, Senior Vice President of TruSpec Golf, joined by Andrew Tursky, Senior Writer for Golf.com, and Jonathan Wall, Managing Editor for Equipment for Golf.com as well. Guys, what's up?
Professor, what's going on? I don't think much has
changed. Mr. Tursky, you're recovered. Feeling a little better here?
Yeah, it's good to be back.
He's back to defend himself.
I couldn't even flu game it last week. It's too far under the weather.
See, we caught him when he couldn't defend himself last week, Tim. We threw him under the bus a bit with the. Although your sister did have a better bag setup than you, I'll say it now since we're all three here. But yeah, you weren't there to defend yourself. I felt kind of bad about that. If you didn't listen to last week's episode, make sure you listen to it just to.
Just kicking a man, while he's down.
Yeah, while he's on his deathbed.
I didn't feel bad about it at all. I no conscience.
You don't feel
over
bad
here,
about so. Much, Tim. That's the thing. You don't feel bad about much.
Nah.
You just let it
shout
rip.
Shout out my sister though. She did have a good bag.
She did.
Yeah, that was awesome, man. So we've got some cool content to cover this week. As we discussed last week, you know, a lot of tour players are coming out of hibernation, and you know, gear topics are going to start coming out. And then got a mailbag question for the week. We'll cover a gear spotlight.
Speaking really quick, Tim, before you keep going on.
Yeah.
Speaking of equipment news, guess who I saw with testing a new driver on social media? Sergio.
Brooks?
Sergio.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And guess what he was testing? Honma TR20.
No way.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. Super interesting.
I mean, Sergio's an equipment free agent, but as you were mentioning that, Tim, I did want to bring that up. It's pretty recent. So anyway.
I think the three of us are all privy to news that, you know, unfortunately can't be shared just yet, not just, you know, internally within what we do in TruSpec, but yeah, suffice to say, the next couple weeks, there will be a lot of stories dropping regarding gear and equipment as we get closer to that restart date for the tour. And it'll be a lot of fun on the pod to be able to cover some of those topics. So, but yeah, we got a cool thing we saw on social media. For those of you that follow on social media, Ricky Fowler and Justin Thomas, they had a little match. You know, they had a match a few weeks back, a lefty match, which is kind of their annual thing. And then they did a persimmon match the other day, which is really neat. So we'll get into that in just a little bit. And then, J-Walt, you had an opportunity to spend time with, you know, one of the luminaries in this industry, you know, really amazing opportunity. Mike Taylor, Artisan Wedges. Mike formerly with Nike Golf and, you know, before that with other R&D teams. His reputation speaks for itself. You know, he's, for those who may not know, he's the man behind the curtain when it comes to Tiger Woods and the sole configurations on his irons and wedges. So I'm really looking forward to hearing, you know, what you were able to get out of Mike when you spent some time with him. And with that, let's get into the first topic for the week, which is that persimmon match. Were you guys able to tune in? And they didn't show much content from that. I almost wish that they had gone live on Instagram and given us a little deeper peek into what they were doing. But it was certainly fun to see that a couple of tour players are bringing out the retro gear and seeing how that works.
The sound of persimmon and Bellotta meeting together is still one of my all-time favorite golf sounds.
Yep.
Right up there with the solid wood contact when you're in the trees and you get to watch it come back in the fairway. I don't know why. That's always a fun one. But yeah, that persimmon and Bellotta. It's such a cool sound. It's a really deep thud. I know that they've tried to replicate it with today's the modern day driver, but it's impossible to do. And I think we just saw all the good shots. I'm pretty sure those guys weren't puring it like that the entire round.
You ever game a persimmon?
I've hit one before. You know, I kind of came into golf right around the time that titanium was starting to increase in popularity. I think like really the first driver, I had a old Wilson that I remember hitting, but I think 975D Titleist was really kind of the first driver that I remember bagging. So, but yeah, that persimmon. Tim, I know you've got a little bit of history with persimmon.
I sure do. We'll get into that in just a minute. How about you, Tursky? You ever? So when I say game a persimmon, J-Wall, I mean not just hit a shot or two on the range, but throw that thing in the bag and get it out on the golf course and see how it works.
No,
I've never gained one. They're definitely before my time. But my college coach used to always bring out persimmon woods and blotto balls and have us hit balls just to see like how bad it really goes. But yeah. when it comes to Ricky versus JT, I really wish they treated it like their lefty match where they showed like basically every shot, because it's really cool seeing these guys, because everyone's argument is that the ball's too good, the driver's too good, they would never be able to play with the old stuff. It's like, we want to see that. And it kind of makes me wish there was either like an exhibition match or a tournament, a throwback tournament, where they play at like a Marion or a Philly Cricket Club, or I don't know, you can name a million different courses, but, you know, have 8, 12, 25 guys go out there with the old stuff and just see how they do. It would kind of shut up the critics, too.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
I think that's a great idea. You know, and
I remember
it's been discussed before, but I think they need to bring it back. Come on, let's get a throwback. Yeah,
I saw that. You know, they posted that Ricky was able to break par, shot, you know, put a 70 on the card. JT withheld his score. I think it was a good bit higher, and that's typically what you would see out of this older equipment. Is that when people are striping it, hitting it out of the middle of the face, square face, they'll be able to play with most anything. It's when you're just a little bit off, you know, hitting some of that old persimmon stuff. It doesn't take much to miss hit it, and the misses are pretty extreme. So
it does make you appreciate what, like, Jack Nicklaus did over his career.
100%.
He basically finished top 10 every single major he played, you know?
Yeah.
100%.
Just unbelievably consistent ball striker.
So as J-Wall mentioned, I do have a little bit of personal history here. I gamed a Cleveland TC15 all the way up until December of 1999. And that was all the way through my time in college.
Whoa.
And yeah, there's Tursky's like, whoa, what are you doing here, man? I gamed that all the way through my college career. And I know this, you know, I know that those last couple years, I was the only guy in the field playing persimmon. It drove my coach Puggy Blackman crazy. Shout out to Puggy. Puggy, you know, coached a lot of great players throughout his career with David Duvall and Stuart Sink and so many other more, but so many others. But yeah, bottom line is I found that, you know, at the time we're talking, I was an exceptional ball striker and an exceptional driver of the golf ball, and I didn't have a problem hitting it out of the middle of the face and square in the face.
And humble.
And the longest drives I ever hit were with that persimmon, man. The longest drives I ever hit were with that persimmon.
Persimmon until 99, so you were like the original woke hipster in the golf world.
He was the collegiate version of Justin Leonard and Davis Love.
Davis actually gamed that TC15 too. That was,
yeah, I know.
That was the same model that he gamed all the way until he switched to the 975D, which was the model that I switched to, the 975D. So there's kind of a little bit of parallel there. But yeah, I mean, what I had for skill in driving the golf ball and hitting iron shots, I lacked for skill around the greens and putting. So I don't want to blow up my abilities too much here because, you know, at the end of the day, it clearly didn't work out because I couldn't get it in the hole. But at the end of the day, I did hit that driver fantastically well. I always remember playing a couple of junior golf tournaments, hitting, you know, a 380, 390-yard drive with that thing. Yeah, there was a little bit of help with turf and wind, but bottom line is those things went forever. You know, the thing about those golf clubs is that, as I mentioned earlier, if you were off just a tiny little bit, a lot of times the ball didn't even get airborne. And if it did get airborne, it would be miles and miles offline. So
the thing is, just thinking about what Tursky said with having a throwback tournament on tour, it would be really difficult for a tour player, a modern day tour player, to get acclimated to a persimmon driver. You know, Tim and I talked about this off air. One of the things I point out is angle of attack.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't attack a persimmon driver with that upward angle the same way you do with today's drivers. So, you'd have to retool a lot just to get it accurate.
Yep. And then the other part of this too is that just building it would be a major issue in today's game. Mm-hmm. So here's a pop quiz for Andrew. Do you know what whipping is?
Is that a feral term?
It's not really feral. So remember the little nylon windings around a persimmon, like the neck?
Yeah, between yeah, yeah.
The transition. That's, it was kind of,
that's kind of what
it's
I
kind
meant.
Of like a feral. Yeah, yeah. yeah.
Right.
So
right.
How many people, J-Wall, how many people that are, you know, advanced club builders, you know, like all of our team that works with our fulfillment in production, I'd bet you that maybe only one guy even knows what whipping is. And these guys are some of the best. The game has certainly evolved, but I don't even know how you could get the golf clubs made because there are so few people that know how to whip a club.
Yeah, I mean, so, I would. I mean, how many people do you think? And again, we're just completely guessing here. How many people, or I shouldn't say people, but how many club builders do you think are out there that could actually
whip a driver?
Whip a driver.
It's probably less than 5% at this point, and that's even going. I would even maybe say even less.
Yeah,
I know that they don't even teach it in club building school anymore. If you go to like Maltby or Mitchell or anything like that, any of those golf schools.
There's no
schools.
Reason.
Why would they ever teach it?
So. Yeah, you're teaching something that's, you know, it's an archaic method. There's no real reason to have to teach whipping a golf club. But yeah, I would say, yeah, 5% or less. I can't imagine it's very popular.
I'll say this much. If you're under 45 years old and you're a professional club builder, I almost guarantee you don't know how to whip a golf club. So it would be, you know, the club builders out there that really have been around for a while. But, you know, the interesting thing here, which is a perfect segue into the gear spotlight would be, okay, well, what was the first metalwood, the first true metalwood? And you got to go back to Gary Adams. Gary Adams, 1979, the TaylorMade Burner, and good old Pittsburgh Persimmon. You know, that was a game changer. And that was our first metalwood design that obviously changed the game forever. And so, you know, what do I take away from that transition from persimmon into metalwoods? It changed the way people actually swing. And so that's a really interesting, I think, take on the whole subject matter, is that every few years, 10, 15, 20 years, there's some major advancement in golf clubs, whether it's through grips, heads, shafts, specs, balls, etc. And when these researchers and developers come up with these technologies, it actually changes the way players need to swing. Look at Iron Byron, Byron Nelson. You know, Byron Nelson was one of the first guys to game steel shafts. And if you look at his golf swing, it's the first old school golf swing that really started to resemble a modern swing. Before that, you know, the Bobby swing and the Bobby Jones, you know, style swings that were very loose and kind of fluid. A lot of that had to do with playing hickory. And so when folks went to steel, they had to start swinging differently. So what would you guys say in the modern era is the thing that's changed the technique the most when it came to the evolution of gear?
I think probably like CG placement, how it continues to get low and either rearward or forward, and CG adjustability. I mean, that's been like the big game changer for the last 10 years, I think. What do you think, J-Wall?
Yeah, I would probably say that, or maybe iron construction.
That's come a long ways. Just
I feel like iron construction. You know, if you look at areas of the industry that have really seen a massive spike in changes, you know, irons were one of those areas where it kind of felt like we got to a point with drivers where the technology was good. It could still be refined. Some changes could be made to pick up ball speed, but they were pretty close to the ceiling in iron design. You know, we've seen, now pretty much every manufacturer out there has some sort of a hollow cavity iron, multi-material with some sort of a springy face. So yeah, I would say just the overall construction of irons, that, and you know, we're kind of starting to see some companies, and when I say some, I'm, you know, looking at Cobra, but some that are starting to dabble in just different face designs for drivers. But
Yep.
Yeah, I mean CG for sure is a huge one. What do you think, Tim? I mean, would you agree with
those? I think it's the golf ball.
Golf ball.
I would agree with both of them. I think head volume is huge. Kind of an interesting thing looking at some research and studies, and this would make sense that with the emergence of these really forgiving technologies, high MOI designs in both driver heads and irons, we've seen that the strike patterns on the faces of clubs for tour players has actually gotten a little bigger. They don't need to be quite as precise as they used to. Now, that doesn't mean that they're hitting it all over the face. It just means that, you know, when the pattern used to be the size of a dime in the past, now it's a few millimeters bigger in diameter, but it's not like they're hitting it off the toe and the heel. But we've seen that there's just a hair less precision with strike point on the face compared to old school, you know, product design. And I think that, you know, it's because it allows them to. And then the big thing for me here is not just CG placement and head volume, but I think the golf ball. I think a lot of these technologies, it's actually changed the way that courses are both designed potentially. It changes the entire strategy for a lot of players with these lower spinning golf balls. They can't hit, you know, as broad a catalog of shots when you're looking at curvature and hitting shots, you know, trajectory, flighting shots. And so you see a lot of people that are not trying to work it. There aren't a lot of Bubba Watsons out there trying to work the ball significantly anymore. They're trying to hit a lot of straight shots and work it back against the wind to get some better stopping power. But I would say the golf ball is a huge piece, going from wound construction into, you know, solid construction all the way through with multi-layers. Obviously, the cover technologies. The ball is really kind of changed everything from a design standpoint, and now the golf clubs have to match what the golf ball does. So that's kind of my take on it, you know. But where does it go next? I honestly don't know. You know, when you look at putter design, wedge design, I think we're starting to see some putter shaft technologies that are emerging. People are looking at putter shafts. I think you're going to see, you know, some evolution with putters and wedges, because those have been fairly stagnant for, you know, a really long time. You're starting to see some really interesting putter designs, whether it's a Biomech or an Axis One, stuff like that. And there definitely always existed, you know, really unique looking putters. Most unique being probably A-Rod's. the good old bat putter.
He's gonna be a constant staple. We talked about his gear last week, and now we're talking about the putter that he had in the
that
bag.
That bag is legendary, man. It can't ever die.
Putter. He'll never live
the
that ball, one
the
day.
Bat putter. But you know, where does it go from here? I'm not exactly sure. I think there are a lot of folks looking into you know, shaft technologies that increase stability and decrease variation. So you know, interesting topic, how the golf swing changes and evolves as the equipment changes. The players have to adjust their golf swings accordingly. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see where it ends up. But that kind of gets us into mailbag for the week, Jonathan. We got a really good one this last week that was kind of based off of Three Bill Bag. What do you got for us?
Yeah, so Samuel Hoarth asked us, he reached out on the Instagram Fully Equipped account. If you ever want to reach out and ask us a question, it may end up as a mailbag on the podcast. The handle for our Instagram is @FullyEquippedGolf. And Samuel asked, he said, hey gents, just discovered the show and loving it. I have a question for you if you don't mind. I have been planning on upgrading my irons and wedges this year. He's currently playing Titleist 714 AP2 irons and SM6 wedges. And he's tempted to try and find a great set of older irons and refinish/rebuild them to my specs. Any advice? My college gamers were Titleist 660s, so that's the thought process. Also, Tim, he wanted to know, he lives a rough life. He lives on Maui and works on Oahu. So sorry, Samuel, for your terrible digs, and wanted to know if you had any recommendations for fitting in the islands.
So first and foremost, when it comes to fitting in the islands, it's a market that we've been very interested in exploring with mobile, because we know that there aren't a lot of options out there. So, you know, our team is very familiar with some distributors and some retail shops in that market. specifically in Maui, I think the options are fairly limited. I recall that there's a golf store right next to the airport that actually wasn't half bad when I went in there. It's where I rented a set when I went over to play. I can't remember the name of that place. It was Camille Bay, I want to say. It was over on Lanai. So, but I'll reach out to him via email and kind of give him a couple of options that he can explore. Now, as far as the main question here, which is looking at an older set, refinishing it, and gaming it, if we're talking muscle back blades, which is kind of sounding where we're going with some of this, you probably, the big thing you got to be careful of here is the loft package. 32, 33 degree six iron compared to nowadays it's around 30. So obviously with more loft, it's probably going to go a little bit higher, spin a little bit more. I would probably say as far as refinishing them, make sure that you pick somebody that has a lot of credibility in the industry when it comes to repair work. I've seen some, real Frankenstein jobs when people try to refinish clubs. And what's the impact of, poor finishes aside from just, cosmetics? It can flake off over time. Obviously, the finish does have a little bit of an impact, minimal impact over ball speed, but it does have a little bit of an impact over spin, as we know. That's the whole reason that players play raw wedges as opposed to plated wedges. So when you're talking about the finishing of the club, it could affect ball spin. You'd have to look at the loft packages, make sure that they make sense. Now, if you're talking cavity back irons, I would say that if you're going to take your 714s compared to, original OG cavity backs going back to the Ping I 2 days, if that's the route that you're going, number one, you're probably going to hit it a good bit higher with those OG cavity backs because they hadn't started strengthening lofts. And one of the reasons they strengthened lofts was to bring the window down. When they add all this technology to increase both ball speed and increase spin and launch, and make the golf club more forgiving by, increasing MOI, the unintended side effect is that the ball tends to go up significantly more, tends to climb and launch higher. So one of the ways that they mitigate against that is they strengthen the lofts. So it's not just about making you hit it further, it's about trying to get you to hit it through the right windows too. So playing a weaker loft package in a cavity back iron that still has, some of that those MOI features and weight properties, the ball's definitely going to fly higher and spin more. If you're going to do this, I'd probably recommend moving up a set of tees because you're definitely going to hit it shorter. And I think that's the way that you're going to enjoy the game and your score won't go up significantly. So if you're a black tee guy, move up to the blues, et cetera. So that's kind of my hot take on it.
What if you're like a 714 and you go back to say like 710s and you found an older set? I mean, refinishing it, are we just talking like just kind of getting the clubs looking new again? I mean, would that include doing anything to the grooves if they were a little worn out? I mean, we've talked about the issues with having a set of wedges regrooved before. So
yeah, I would probably have them
same thing to a set of irons.
Yeah, I would. If we're going to refinish it, it all depends upon the condition of the groove. If they're really, really worn and they're getting kind of flat in the middle, you need grooves on your irons, especially in the mid irons and getting into the long irons. They definitely are going to help increase that face friction to get the proper spin rates on the ball. Now, that being said, with the higher loft packages, maybe, it's a little bit of a trade-off. My thing would be looking at like a set of 710s to 714s, the last two numbers on that is kind of the demarcation of the year that they were launched. So we're talking about a 2010 product compared to a 2014 product. The iron technology, I don't know for you guys, but for me, the iron technology really started to proliferate in advance right around 2009, 10, 11. So if you're playing a cavity back iron predating not 2009, 10, or 11, I would say that you're probably dealing with significantly lower CORs, more conventional designs, less tech, less MOI. But once you reach that point of 2010 or so, then all of a sudden we started seeing the irons get a lot hotter and a lot more forgiving, a lot higher ball flights, a lot more ball speed, and ball speed sped out across the face. I'll say one of the bigger things for me is like variable face technology. in conjunction with perimeter weighting. If you are playing a non-variable variable face thickness technology compared to something that is, you're going to notice a pretty big difference in forgiveness. And I know that that was a really big thing with the TaylorMade metal woods going back into the mid-2000s. One of the reasons that they became so popular is that they were pretty easy to hit. And they were one of the first groups, I believe, they call it inverted cone, to use variable face thickness. So, you know, if you don't have variable face thickness on your products, you're probably, you know, you better hit it out of the middle. That's all I'll say. So, what's the last retro set you gamed, Jonathan? I know that you've been in some Strixons and, you know, all the more modern stuff.
I mean, I think I would, I guess, like, quote unquote retro. I had a set of Titleist 731 PMs that I've mentioned here on the pod before. Those were the lefty irons that were made specifically for Phil Mickelson. It was a blended set, which still at that time wasn't all that popular, but it was cavity back long irons kind of transitioning into blade short irons in the, I guess it was about the 8-iron through pitch. And I just wore them out and I was kind of done with them. And then one day I saw somebody playing a set and I'm like, oh, I'm going to go pick them up. So 731 PMs. I mean, they're not that retro, but you got to go back a little ways to find Phil playing those bad boys. What about you, Tercy?
He's already playing a retro set right now.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've really only played like three different sets of irons like since the beginning of high school. I had KZG Blades, then I had Callaway X-Forged 2007s, and then Callaway X-Forged 2013s, which is what I play now. So
I will say this, those 13s are, I played the 13s as well. Those were probably those were my favorite Callaway irons ever.
I've hit them against modern irons, and it's just like they're not significantly better. Plus, I like the X-Forged. I like the way they look. I think they look exactly how an iron should look, so I'm not in a rush to get those out of the bag, really.
Groove configuration is a lot different, too, than today's. Those are really
– yeah.
It's a ton of grooves packed in there. Some people like that, but you know, if you look at – compare it to today's irons – the grooves are spaced out a lot more than those.
You notice that when you look at the P7TW, the differences in groove configuration and sizing, it's pretty you know, striking the first time you look at a P7TW compared to everything else. Just speaks to the fact that Tiger, you know, this guy's super retro with his gear. He's always been, and that I think that was a conundrum for Nike for many years, is that they're trying to advance technologies to help the everyday player, but the poster child is super retro as far as the way that he preferred all his gear. And I think that's the perfect segue to get into the Mike Taylor interview, Jonathan. As we mentioned in the lead-in to the episode, had a chance to get to Fort Worth. That's the headquarters of Artisan. For those listeners out there that aren't familiar with Artisan are really high-end. They do mostly wedges and putters. I think they do some irons as well.
Not publicly.
Not public irons.
Although there are some Artisan irons floating around.
Right.
Bernhard Langer's got them in the bag.
Yeah.
That's right. Does. So what is Artisan? Artisan is the brainchild, you know, of Mike Taylor and his team. And basically, who is Mike Taylor? Well, I'll let Jonathan tell you guys a little bit more. I would say that he is, you know, modern day. He is the GOAT when it comes to iron and wedge design, specifically sole configurations. And anybody that's really close to the equipment world will tell you that the geometry and sizing and shaping of the sole, I mean, we heard it with Shinye Mura in her interview the last 2 weeks. It doesn't matter what technology and what metals and, you know, what you do to your iron. If you don't get the sole configuration right, it doesn't really matter. And so everybody that understands club design knows that the geometry and shaping of the sole is crucially important to the performance of the club. And as you said, Andrew, Mike's kind of the GOAT when it comes to the geometry of the sole. So let's get into the Mike Taylor interview.
All right. We're pleased to be joined by one of the all-time greats in the history of club making. He's worked on clubs for Tiger Woods, Jack Nicklaus, Ben Hogan, and Rory McIlroy. Master Craftsman Mike Taylor from Artisan Golf. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to have you guys today. Welcome to Artisan Golf.
taping back to where it all began, club making, or golf for that matter, wasn't really on your radar growing up. How did you get your start in the industry?
I was working at a company here in Fort Worth back in 1987, hadn't been out of college very long. And during that time, I was interviewing to go to work in aerospace here in Fort Worth, big aerospace town. Now we've got Lockheed, Bell Helicopter, all that was General Dynamics at the time. But the company I was working for, they had some connections to the Ben Hogan Company. And the owner, which was a fellow that my father had grown up with, he came to me one day and goes, "Hey, there's this company here in town. They're looking for a guy that has some of your skills." So I go over there, and that's where I met Tom Stites. And I think he had to sell his soul for the guys over there to want to hire a hayseed guy like me. Here you go. Here's the hayseed kid, you know. But he's like, he always told me, says, I told him, Mike, this boy's from the country. He can fix things, you know. And that's kind of where it started, in doing the, you know, documentation and testing and just kind of. But it's about people. It's about the people I met there that, you know, I didn't really know that I wanted to spend 30 something years making golf clubs at that point in time. But I found some passion because of some of the things that I saw and then I learned, and those relationships kind of were the foundation for the passion that I have for golf equipment. And at some point, I think that most people do anything long enough that you're like, I don't really want to go learn to do nothing else. I don't want to work on airplanes at this point. I like golf because it's a process. It's a process that it starts with a beginning, and I got to see the final result. It's not where I just make one little part of this. You know, you have some control of how a number of components end up creating a valuable tool for someone.
You mentioned the people. I know Gene Shealy was a mentor who had a major impact on your career trajectory. Who was Gene to you?
Well, Gene was the master model maker to Ben Hogan Company. I mean, if you look at a lot of those shapes, and he was the ears that listened to Mr. Hogan. And I'm sure that Mr. Hogan tested Gene's creations, and they worked very closely together. And, you know, there's such a history there of that influence of a man that company had his name. It was him. And it's and Gene was he was a brilliant guy, way ahead of his time, as far as, he's probably the person that made me understand how important that a golf shaft is and everything. I mean, you look at those heads, or you look at the persimmon woods that he shaped and influenced, but you look at the apex shaft, and you look at some of the other things that he was involved in that were huge breakthroughs for golf. And I believe that shaft is as important as how nice those heads were and how well they were put together, as far as why people love that iron product.
What did you learn from watching Mr. Hogan and Gene interact on a daily basis?
I never stood by and watched, you know, a conversation with Mr. Hogan and Gene, but I do know this. There were times that when I would be in Gene's model shop, and maybe an athlete would call about something, and Gene would pick up the phone, you know, a landline, of course, and have those conversations. But I do remember a time when one of Mr. Hogan's admins called down the shop and goes, "Is Gene in the shop? Mr. Hogan wants to talk to him." And I'm like, put the phone down, and I go over there and to, you know, "Gene, Mr. Hogan wants to talk to you on the phone." And it was so different. There was such a level of respect that he had for Mr. Hogan that he went over there and made sure he had paper and he had pencil and he was sitting down before he picked up that phone. And I'm like, wow, that's different. You know, maybe I really didn't. I saw what I recognized was the respect, right? but there was a lot of history there, obviously, before I was ever there, of them working together to create all these great products and things. But I could always tell when Gene spoke of Mr. Hogan that it was different than the rest.
I know you've had a long working relationship with Tiger. Gene and Mr. Hogan had a similar professional relationship. Do you see any similarities in the way you and Tiger have interacted over the years?
I think if you look at back in the beginning when we started doing work for Tiger, a lot of it was, okay, what's the goals here? We had to set ourselves some goals. We had to do some measuring. We had to do, you know, that foundation. Right. Then we start making prototypes for him to test. Yeah. He gives us feedback. We react to the feedback. And, you know, and then that came to developing products specifically for him to play at the level that he plays. Then we took those designs and took them to a production level, and then other players became exposed to what our work was working with him. I mean, there's an endless amount of great players that have played product that is a result of how we work together. You know, it's like, here's this young guy that the world already knows is gonna leave his mark on this game. And he was obviously very important to Nike. So that was a very serious mission that I was there. We had to find out. What I like about the relationship that we've always had with some of those athletes and that it's never changed is that we're trying to make something better than what you got. And then later down the road, who are we trying to take out of the bag?
Right.
Our own work. You got to beat yourself. That's when it gets kind of, okay, we've made this product for, and now we need something different. So now the task is you've got to go defeat yourself.
Right.
What was it like watching Tiger test?
Incredible.
Can you describe it for me? Is he pretty vocal when he's testing product?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of times where he would tell us, this is what I'm going to do. You know, this is what I want the golf ball to do. And then we watched, you know, the enablement, the what part of how the tool affects the ball striking. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Everybody, when you mention that ball striking, Tiger's ball striking, that, okay, it's not necessarily of what it looks like from a distance. It's what it looks like when you're close enough that you hear it. It's different. There's a certain, there's just a beautiful energy. It's like that, you know, hey, you hand Eric Clapton a guitar, it don't sound like when you hand me one, man. Okay. So it's just different. I think it's the energy. I think it's that pure delivery, the perfect interaction of where the turf's involved, the ball's involved, but it's got a lot of energy.
Do you and Tiger still keep in contact? Does he bounce ideas off you at all?
We talk some, and I'm always there. Hey, guys that we've worked with in our career, we're always there to help, you know, with things. So it's been a while, but he knows how to get a hold of me.
You come in here and you've worked with so many elite players. You've been in the industry for 30 years and pretty much done it all from a design standpoint on the iron and wedge side. What keeps you motivated?
You know, the motivation is to help people. Hey, I've been employed in this city for a long time making golf clubs. And part of that is if you look at the history of the tools just in my career, okay, first day I go to work, to interview at the Ben Hogan Company, I was given a tour, the beautiful smell of persimmon sawdust and the grind shop and that. It's different now. We don't make persimmon woods anymore.
Yeah.
So there's this evolution, And when you got to recognize that we have to continue to evolve if the conditions of the game change and the athletes change, then the tools have got to follow. And that's, and we love here at Artisan, one of the foundations for what we really have passion for is helping people. We want to help people. We want to build something that you're eager to go practice with and train with and then take to the golf course with a certain level of confidence. It's no different than when we worked with, you know, all those tour athletes or whatever. We're all golfers. It's the same. Bring your expertise of what we know and continue to want to learn about golf equipment, putters, wedges, irons, whatever it is, to help people have more enjoyment playing this game. Yeah. Hard game.
What would have happened if they had pushed you to move to Oregon? Would you have gone?
I doubt it. I mean, my family's here. My family's important to me.
Yeah.
And I like being here. It worked out good for everybody. We're in a facility that's the product of, you know, that's the reason this exists in Fort Worth, is because that relationship that, you know, Tom founded with Bob Wood and the people at Nike. And I think that it's also easy to look at the Dallas-Fort Worth area as what kind of asset this area is. If you're taking care of professional athletes all over the world, Dallas-Fort Worth Airport right there, and it's a great place to have something located, because you've got East Coast players, West Coast players. No one's got to fly across country to get here.
I know your son races cars. Was that one of your hobbies as well when you were growing up?
I grew up a country kid. Hey, we played baseball, football. Yeah. All that stuff, worked a lot. So we went to the races once with my son when he was very young, and boy, next thing you know, man, I want to do this and that. And, you know, I had no idea of what all that looked like. But we ended up buying him a little race car, one that was being raced by probably 12, 13-year-old kids, you know. And I'm like, I still remember the first day we went to a little practice thing. Had his fire suit, all this. I picked the kid up and put him through the window of that car. He started it, and no, he's years from even having a driver's license. Right. He's going to down to where you line up to go on the track, call it the lineup shoot, and I'm thinking, what have I done? Well, by the end of that day, you could feel his passion for things. And you know what? As a parent, you try to identify things that your children are passionate about, and you get all involved in it, because there's certain leverage that comes with that.
Yeah.
We bring good report cards home if we want to continue to race. My son's 20, I mean, he's close to being, he's 27 years old now, and he still races.
Yeah.
So it's something that we were always involved with as a family. And it was something that if you want to be good at it, it's kind of like building these clubs. You
got
to go to work.
Yeah.
Gotta go to work. No one's just gonna pull over, and I mean, racing's about who's the fastest, man. So you gotta have a driver that's got some skills, but at the end of the day, you hope to have a better car than everybody else.
Who had the biggest influence on your career?
Gene Shealy. From a mentor standpoint, yeah.
What about someone other than Gene? Is there anyone else who impacted your career in a similar way?
Oh, just some of the people that I've worked with. You know, I mean, I've got some incredible friends that I've worked with that, you know, DR, Franklin, David Franklin and I worked together for a lot of years, and he was absolutely the best at what he did. And we worked together as a team a lot, and there's always been a lot of, he was here a few days ago, you know, and it's, you know, we still text and things. There's just a lot of people around the industry, and I still, you know, I talk to Tom from time to time. Scott Crawl and I have been friends for a number of years and everything. And, you know, Scotty came to work here at a time when things were, you know, career's always got its ups and downs. And I think it was kind of a time where maybe I wasn't really getting what I expected out of my what I did every day. And that man helped me find some more passion for what I was doing. And I won't forget that.
I know it was a difficult time, but describe what it was like when you found out Nike was exiting the hard goods industry in 2016. It was shocking to me. I remember where I was. Did you feel the same way?
It was. There were a lot of people in this building that day that were very shocked, for sure. I had this feeling that things were going to change, but I didn't know if they were going to change that much. So it is what it is, you know. A little bit more than that's not saying that it just, hey, things happen or whatever. Yeah, it was disappointing, right? I looked at it from a selfish standpoint of look at all these athletes that we're building tools for, that we had these relationships for, and now we got to stop doing that. That wasn't going to be fun.
Yeah.
So, you know, at that point, we worked here for a lot of months because of the support that Nike wanted to continue to provide the athletes. That in this building needed to be transitioned, right? So there were a number of us, man, we worked for, when did that happen? August?
Yeah, it was
August.
July.
Was it July? Yeah. July, August, somewhere. Well, you know, in the end, John and I, and maybe a few other, but for sure John and I, we left here on a Friday afternoon, and that was our last day, you might say, on the Nike payroll. Monday morning, we walk right back in that door over here, and here we go. It's artisan time. So during that time, helping these, we started finding out. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and I really didn't want to talk about it a whole lot for a while. And then John starts looking at these, you know, opportunities. Bottom line, I want to continue. Any of us that work here today, we want to continue our career doing what we do. Better have some tools, man. Yeah. And there's a lot of unique tools that we use in this business. So, hey, at that point, early on, I'm like, what are you going to do, Mike? One thing I was never had a day's fear of is being able to take care of my family. What I would have wondered about most is how much passion could I find for where I was headed next? If I went to work at the nuclear power plant down there near Glen Rose or wherever, is it just gonna be a field filler? This is the years that you did until you retired? Or is there any passion there for what you did? And finally, I found, I guess, that little selfishness in there goes, hey, why don't you do this?
Right.
So, and I'm glad we finally got to that place and put this team here at Artisan together so that we can continue to do what we love to do.
What's it like working out of the same facility where you made Nike clubs, but now it's Artisan?
It was different at first, but we were here as a small group of people for a long time after a lot of the folks that we worked with here were gone. It was different, but it always was a little rough when some people would come to visit or whatever, and then they would kind of start thinking about, you know, that time or whatever. You know what? It's a building. It's our current home. It was our home then. But it's the people here today that are where the passion is or whatever. I look at when people come in here, and I have to remind myself of this sometimes, oh, this is a cool place. Look at the grinding wheels. Look at the CNC machines cutting putters and all of this. But, hey, it's something I've been looking at for years and years and years. You got to step back from it. But at the end of the day, all that doesn't make the difference. It's the people.
Do you have a favorite club you've worked on that sticks out from all your years in the industry?
Yeah, there's been some really cool ones. I mean, you were looking at them earlier. We were talking about them. I love doing those. Hey, doing those irons for the Ben Hogan Company back in 98, man, that was really cool because it's kind of like, hey, getting to, you know, wear the colors again, you know, and the relationship that I had with Gene, I poured not only my passion into those golf clubs, I poured the passion that he gave me.
Having made clubs for Tiger, Nicholas, and Rory, is there anything there, maybe some trait, that those elite ball strikers share as far as what they're looking for in an iron or a wedge?
Well, if you bring Duval and...
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch.
Yeah, but there are people that have excelled to the top of the game because they outwork everybody else at some form, some part of their career. There's enough passion there and drive, and they see the reward. Here's the result of what I want. Got to outwork everybody else to be there. And the equipment is a piece of what you're, because you're going to work hard. What are you working with? So there's, I think that everyone that is assumed at whatever point in golf, when we start going, hey, how do you become the number one player in the world? Got to make more money than everybody else, right? Well, that comes with commitment, a lot of things. But I think that no one that we've ever worked with in our career that have been the number one player did it without having probably put the effort in to get those tools in place that they could practice with that elevated the expectations of themselves when they were in competition.
When you started Artisan, it was with a couple of guys you've worked with for years. You started from ground zero and now it's exploded with interest. What has that been like to see it flourish from the infancy stages?
Yeah, John and I and every man in here, we all should be very proud of where we are today. And you know what? What's the result of? It's the result of the passion and the commitment to the quality level that people have expect from us. All we're doing here, Jonathan, is what people expected us to do. If we'd have gone in here and go, well, let's make this or this or this, and the dude, if that's not your MO, that's failure. The easiest thing for us to do at Artisan is the same thing we've been expected to do. I mean, is it any simpler than that? Because when people establish the expectations of your work, if you take your work to the level of those expectations, it's, you know, it's hard to wreck that. And then I think a lot of people know that we're going to continue to try to, you know, we're always trying to learn a way to make a better tool.
What's the last new thing you learned and added to the Mike T club building arsenal?
You know, since we've started Artisan, we've kind of, if you look at our past, it was a lot of it was production driven. From standpoint, okay, we did the tour support. We took what we learned from the tour support and everything to create, at various points of our career, to create a better consumer product, right? Net. But with Artisan, there's some things that were never really that big a requirement when you're supporting tour athletes globally, all of this, you know, the production standards, those things. And now we do what we want, which is some of it is we've enabled people to come in here and ask us or require us to do things that are cool. Finishes. I wasn't making purple wedges in Nike, dude. So, you know what? But it's nice to see the things that people appreciate along that level. Look at some of these putters that we make. You know, I mean, they're a product of the feedback that we get and the knowledge that John and those guys have of what people need so that they train better, they expect to putt better with it. But, you know, some of the finishing, not a lot of the build scenarios and what, I mean, the results of what we're trying to do here are founded upon performance. You know that. It's always been, does the shaft work correctly? Do we have good turf interaction? Does this provide us the gappings? Or, you know, how does this putter enable us to get into that place where we're comfortable and to roll it right? It's not we build products here that enable you to make decisions with them. We want our wedge products to enable the player to be able to decide where they're going to hit, what that launch window is. So that's just a continuation. But hey, we're always going to find some way to challenge ourselves here at Artisan, because we are looking at, and we'll find that correct time. We're going to do iron product here.
I know a lot of wedges you create, you still do a lot of the checks and processes the old school way that's always worked for you. But I got to ask, where do you see wedge design going in the next decade?
I think a lot of the things that I think the forging technology really has escalated in my career. I mean, I look at the quality of the forgings that we used to get, even that bore the great brand Ben Hogan's name on them, the great player in that brand. The forgings that we've got today, I mean, they're good stuff. Okay. So the production process is somewhat been enabled from a consistency standpoint from that. Okay. We use that right blend of CNC, but I've never been that guy. I mean, the fact that we've got all these guys, okay, where do you qualify? You're a top 10 player in the world. Okay. You're a top 10 player in the world. This is a lob wedge you need. No, they don't work that way. We've got to find, everyone has their own balance requirements of how the tool works for them. That's the reason I still use a grinding wheel, because we just find things, even with our customers or whatever, where we need to make adjustments. That way we find that best balance. It's different. Hey, designed a lot of production wedges, and they're good wedges. Okay. But if you look at what is the foundation of what we learned from working with all them players, size 10 don't fit everybody. So we've enabled ourselves to do what we've always done, which is what we should be expected to do, is if I need to make an adjustment to something so it works for you better, let's get to adjusting it.
If a recreational golfer is going to ask you for advice on the best way to test wedges, what's the one thing you'd tell them?
I think we need to look at it from a balance standpoint, and I think we need to take a fresh approach and look at what enables our game. You know, in conversations I've even had with professional players, look at the game. Look at the advantage that a tour athlete has in certain areas of the game. They outdrive all of us. They hit a 5-iron further than us, okay? From 100 yards, we're all in the game. We can all get on the same playing field at 100 yards or 60 yards or whatever. We need that tool that enables the feel and control but we need to be open-minded from the standpoint of, here's something that concerns me a little bit today. People have started looking at sand irons like they're another gap wedge. Sand iron is not just a gap wedge. It is not just an approach wedge golf club. Our golfing community here in the States, we them lob wedge lovers. That's all good, but it's not necessarily always the club that we need to execute certain shots with. And that sand iron is not just to be used from that yardage where you're comfortable with it. It's that balance of the game. And we try to enable people to understand that during our fitting processes here. We've got being a great golfer, if you look at the people, and you don't have to have a tour card in your pocket to be a great wedge player. I can name you some customers of mine. They can wedge it. They're a threat to anybody from 100. Got to know how to play. Got to know what your wedge game look like. It's not a hit it as hard as you can. There's a certain amount of controls, and oftentimes during the fitting process, we put people in that place where we kind of enable them to understand what that control mechanism is. What would you hit from here? Well, I can hit a lob wedge 100 yards, and you're at 80, and the wind's howling in your face. A lot of people can assume, well, I can get it there. No, you're not. you're fixing to get, you're going to find yourself in a bad place. So, hey, let's get our sand iron out. And there's things around the green where we need to look at. I don't want to see people put their sand wedges in a category that it just fills another gapping. It's a useful tool in a lot of places.
What are the goals you have for Artisan?
There's a few goals there. Okay. We're committed. Hey, I don't know how much longer our careers are. I love doing this still.
Have you thought about that at all?
No. My father asked me not long ago, how much longer are you going to do this? And I'm like, a while. He goes, that's what I thought. So I want to help the people that are helping us here, everyone on the Artisan team, to find passion in what we do, and it's recognizable in the quality and the products that we create for people, the performance. I want to keep digging to find a way to make things better. I want to work with some, the list of friends that we've found in the last 3 years is incredible. I don't want to quit making friends with these people. This is fun, but it's different because there's not as much outside influence that the team here, we can make decisions and we can do what we feel like we want to do. So I want to continue doing that. And, you know, I'd like to build a brand here that exists well beyond me being around, honestly. But I want it to be the same as it is when the guys that are here today are around. I think that's what I don't want to change. I don't want to, whether we're here or not, I don't want that to change. I want to make sure that those young people or whoever we bring in here understand this is what people expect of Artisan.
Mike, thank you again for all the stories and insight. We really appreciate it.
Appreciate you guys. You always, man. Your passion for what we do. You know, this dude, he knows how to hit my trigger.
And that'll do it for episode 42 of Fully Equipped. Can't thank Mike Taylor enough for the time. If you want to follow us on social media for more gear news, you can catch us on Twitter @fully_equipped and on Instagram @fullyequippedgolf. Thanks again for listening. See you next week.